Good morning, everyone. It's 8:30 on Wednesday, December 5th, and we are reconvening the hearing in HP 07-001, application of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP to construct a crude oil pipeline in South Dakota. We're continuing with the applicant's direct case. We had originally scheduled that to be completed yesterday, and that didn't occur. So this morning we're going to attempt to finish up the applicant's case in chief here. Mr. Kennecke, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We'll call Brian Thomas to the stand. While he's advancing, I'll tell you, he's our final witness. He's had some questions which have been addressed to him during the course of the prior testimony. We'll take him through those. He's got one addition to his rebuttal testimony, and we should be moving right along shortly. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you God?
I do.
Good morning, Mr. Thomas. Would you state your name and business address for the record, please?
My name is Brian Thomas, and business address is 450 First Street Southwest, Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
And are you employed in some capacity by the Keystone Project?
Yes, I am. I'm Keystone's coordinator of oil movements.
And can you tell us briefly what that entails?
That would entail development of the pipeline control center, along with the scheduling and oil accounting functions, and as well I have responsibility for development of Keystone's emergency response or oil spill response plan.
Did you provide written testimony in this case?
Yes, I did.
Do you find copies up there at the desk, perhaps at your right?
I have.
And I'll direct your attention first to what's been marked as TC-8D. Is that your direct testimony?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions or corrections to that?
I do not.
And I'll direct your attention to 8R. Is that your rebuttal testimony?
Yes, it is.
Do you have any additions or corrections to that?
I have one addition.
I'll advance and show you what I've marked as Exhibit TC-20. Passed out copies of that this morning to those that seated at the council table and some in the gallery as well. Can you tell me what TC-20 is?
TC-20 is a chart that provides additional information with respect to calculated spill volumes associated with a potential leak, and provides an additional information to that provided on page 5 of my rebuttal testimony.
I note that there is a similar graph depicted on the top of page 5. Is this in addition to that?
Yes, it is, in that it TC-20 provides calculated spill volumes for small and medium-sized leaks in addition to the large leak that was initially provided in my rebuttal testimony. The large leak volumes are identical on the two charts. So it's additional information with respect to the small and medium-sized leaks.
And TC-20 was prepared under your direction?
Yes, it was.
I'll move admission of TC-20 at this time.
No objection. No objection.
Staff?
No objection.
Other interveners? Objection? TC-20 is admitted.
Mr. Thomas, I note at the bottom that the mileposts on the chart that's on page 5 that seem to start at page 4 and continue to 218. It just says milepost, and then I note on TC20 it says, do you see where it says South Dakota miles?
Yes, I do.
Can you discuss what the mileage tables represent at the bottom of each of those?
Yes. The x-axis along the bottom of the chart describes the miles along the state of South Dakota. So milepost 0 corresponds to the North Dakota, South Dakota state line, and then provides the spill volumes throughout the state of South Dakota.
Mr. Thomas, why do you calculate expected spill volumes like this?
Spill volumes are calculated they're calculated such that your oil spill plan is based upon the volumes calculated as a result of this analysis. The code requirements basically require a calculation of what's referred to as a worst case volume. So that would be the maximum volume that a pipeline could spill at any point along the right-of-way. And then you develop your emergency response plan with respect to the amount of equipment, resources, manpower that would be required to deal with such a spill.
Are you going to make any response plans or placements of equipment or people based on the medium or small spill volumes?
No, those are simply provided as additional information. They were provided within the DNV report that was referred to at these proceedings yesterday, and are only provided from that perspective. They're not used in any manner when it comes to planning and developing your emergency response plan.
Mr. Thomas, you've been here over the last couple of days, have you not?
Yes, I have.
And have you, I presume you've heard several questions that have been directed to your attention. I'd like to take you through those. The first one that I recall is, what protection does the SCADA system have from internet hackers or other computer wrongdoers?
Keystone's SCADA system will be designed such that it's independent of other corporate and business-related systems. It will also utilize what I'll call industrial protocols, such that they're encrypted, and it is very difficult for anybody to hack into a system such as this.
Take me through what might happen to the SCADA system in the event of a power outage at any point along the line.
In the event of a power outage, if it's a single station, the local equipment at that station will automatically drive the station to what we call safe levels, such that the maximum allowable operating pressure cannot be exceeded. It's as well important to note that Keystone is a batched pipeline, so it's very important for us to keep the pipeline operating in what we call turbulent flow. And what turbulent flow basically means is that the pipeline operates at a flow rate with a high enough Reynolds number such that the batches do not mix with one another. And in the event Keystone were to lose power to two pump stations consecutively, we're not able to achieve a rate high enough that would keep us in turbulent flow. So the pipeline is shut down by the operator as a result of that. And it would not operate if there are two consecutive pump stations without power.
Mr. Thomas, are you familiar with techniques which would be required to shut down the pipeline for repair?
I am.
Would the pipeline have to be drained completely in order to, say, cut in a valve?
No. There are various techniques to replace sections of pipe, install valves, and perform those sorts of maintenance activities. One of which, of course, would be to drain down the entire line segment. That is very rarely done because, you know, typically those drain-up volumes are so large, they're difficult to deal with. So what is more typically done is a product called a Stoppel tea, and one of the manufacturers of those is T.D. Williamson. Those Stoppel teas can be installed at any point along the pipeline and actually used very similar to a valve. So they can be installed, again, at any point along the pipeline, used as a valve, and then basically you would install these kind of on either side of a section of pipe that you may want to remove or a valve you may want to install, and then you only actually have to drain up then what's in between these two Stoppel fittings.
Mr. Thomas, would there be a reason to put check valves at all 14 valve sites in South Dakota?
Well, check valves are again, as was discussed yesterday, they're suitable for preventing this backflow that was referred to yesterday. So they prevent flow in the direction reverse to the normal pipeline flow. So in many instances, dependent upon the elevation profile, they don't provide a suitable form of shutoff because they would allow, if a check valve, for example, was placed in a valley, the part of the liquid column that's on the upstream side of that valley would flow directly through the check valve because, again, they're only designed to prevent flow in the reverse direction. So in many instances, they don't provide the protection they're only suitable for locations where you want to prevent this backflow. And the remotely controlled gate valves that Keystone's proposing in the other locations prevent, of course, flow in both directions.
I believe there was a question about remote sensing of leaks from aerial surveillance. Did you hear a question like that?
Yes, I did.
Are you familiar with that kind of technology?
I'm familiar with a few of the forms of that technology that are what I would consider at this point more or less in their infancy. And there's more work being done every day with respect to these systems, but at this point, to my knowledge, there hasn't been a system developed that would be useful from an aerial patrol perspective in an application such as the Keystone Pipeline.
Would you consider using one should they be developed to the point where they are?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Finally, my recollection is that there were questions on oil spill remediation. Mr. Thomas, are you an oil spill remediation expert?
No, I'm not an expert. I have been involved in some activities that included remediation work, but I certainly wouldn't consider myself an expert.
Would you say you're generally familiar with remediation techniques?
Yes, I have been involved in a few of these activities, so I've seen some of these techniques.
Could you discuss generally for us what kind of remediation techniques would be available in the event of an oil spill in South Dakota?
Yes. There are a number of techniques that are available and are utilized dependent upon the particular situation. In the event there were a spill and cleanup and remediation necessary, these activities are all done in conjunction with federal, state authorities, as well as the landowner involved. Some of the more typical techniques would be to excavate the contaminated soil, dispose of that soil in a approved landfill, or actually incinerate the soil on site. And then, of course, replace what has been removed. There are also techniques that I'll call bioremediation or land farming of a particular site. What that involves is tillage and adding fertilizer and actually allowing the microorganisms that are there to deteriorate or eat the hydrocarbon. There are also what I'll call natural recovery techniques, which are sometimes applied in areas such as wetland, where it would really any sort of additional activity in that area might be worse for the environment than just leaving things as they are. So that is sometimes applied in certain specific areas. And then finally, there are also the use of dispersants and other chemicals that assist with degradation of the oil are sometimes used.
The witness is available for cross-examination.
Mr. Rasmussen, please proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas, a lot of the witnesses referred to you in their questions, so you must be the man with all the answers. Is that right?
I guess time will tell.
All right.
Ask his wife.
Looking at your direct testimony, starting with paragraph 7 on page 2, you indicate that you're responsible for the information provided in section 2.3.2 of the application on quote-unquote abnormal operations. How do we define the term abnormal operations, or how do you define that term, I guess?
Abnormal operations, I guess very simply defined, is something that wouldn't be normal. It would involve an upset pipeline condition, conditions where, such as a loss of communications, an instantaneous loss of a pumping unit or pumping station, something along those lines that would take you away from steady state flow conditions.
And I think in the next paragraph, paragraph 8, you actually list some of those things that you've just mentioned, including unintended closure of valves or shutdowns, decrease in pressure, et cetera, correct?
That's correct.
And those are all things that as a person in your position, you recognize that are things that can possibly occur and can cause problems with a pipeline such as this, correct?
That's correct.
Turn to page 7 of your testimony. I'm looking at paragraph 11. You refer to the Operations Control Center. That is located in Canada, is that right?
That it's located in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, okay. Yes.
Okay. And that's manned 24/7, correct?
Correct.
Is there any going to be any place in South Dakota where there will be a manned facility 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
Not 24/7 in South Dakota.
I think I might just
add that we'll certainly have people that are on call 24/7, but there won't be a per se manned facility.
Mm-hmm. My understanding from what I've seen is that at this point in time, the intention is to have some sort of facility in Yankton manned by three people. Is that right?
We've identified Yankton as a location for a maintenance facility. The exact numbers of people have not yet been determined.
And I assume then there'll be maintenance facilities similar to that up and down the line?
There will.
Where would the next one to the north be of the Yankton facility?
That hasn't been determined as of yet.
Somewhere in North Dakota or maybe not even that?
At this stage, I really couldn't say accurately.
How about to the south? What's the nearest manned facility to the south of Yankton?
That again has not been developed to this point.
Okay. Turn to page 8. And the first bullet point there in the top of the page, you mentioned that you're going through the various means of leak detection, and the first one you mentioned is remote monitoring by the SCADA system, is that right?
Well, remote monitoring performed by the OCC operator.
All right. Are all the bullet points related to, or that talk about, well, let's do this. Why don't you explain to me, what exactly is the SCADA system and how does it operate?
I would describe the SCADA system as basically being comprised of three components. We basically have the field devices that are installed at the pump stations, valve sites along the pipeline right away. We have a communication system that basically takes information from that equipment and then provides it to what I'll call a central or host computer that's located in Calgary. And then that information is displayed on an HMI or a human-machine interface that allows the operator to view that information and also execute commands.
And so the operator portion of it would be what you're talking about in the first bullet point then?
That's correct.
All right. And that remote monitoring is typically able to detect leaks down to approximately 25 to 30%. So that would still allow for a significant leak if you've got 25 or 30% leaking, correct, without it being detected?
Well, that system on its own would, but that's...
I realize, and you have further systems, but yeah. With that one on its own, correct? Is that what it means, that it would allow for a leak of up to 25% without it being detected by the OCC operator?
Well, not necessarily. It's just it would take a longer period of time, likely.
Well, why don't you explain to me maybe I'm misinterpreting. What is the statement? Remote monitoring is typically able to detect leaks down to approximately 25 to 30% of pipeline flow rate. What does that mean?
Well, that is intended to mean more or less instantaneous detection of a leak. So that in this case, what we're saying is that on more or less an instantaneous basis, that an operator could detect a leak down to that threshold.
Then the next bullet point says, next are software-based volume balance systems that monitor injection and delivery volumes, and those systems are typically able to detect leaks down to approximately 5% of pipeline flow rate. Tell me what you're referring to there, please.
Well, and that again is on a more or less, I'll say, instantaneous basis. These volume balance systems look at volumes that are injected into the system and those volumes that are delivered out of the system, and do basically an over-short comparison.
And then next are the computational pipeline monitoring, which you state could detect leaks down to a level of approximately 1.5 to 2% of pipeline flow rate. What is that?
That is what I would refer to as a complex, sophisticated transient model of the pipeline system. And it, again, dependent upon the size of the leak, can detect leaks down to this threshold of, as we've indicated, 1.5 to 2%.
So a leak below 1.5 to 2% potentially is not detected by this SCADA system. Is that right?
Well, I could refer you as well to my rebuttal testimony, and under. Item number four, I've described another system that will allow Keystone to detect leaks below that 1.5 to 2% threshold.
Well, we'll get to that, but as far as your initial direct testimony was concerned, that was the threshold level of, it was 1.5 to 2%, correct? With the SCADA system.
Yes.
The rebuttal testimony that you just referenced, is that Is that part of the SCADA system also, or is that some other type of system?
No, that's all part of the SCADA system as well.
If we were to use the 2% level, that would is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe, and if we look at a, I think right now there's contracts for 495,000 barrels per day. Using that number, I think that would equate if you got a little over 20,700,000 gallons. Is that sound about right? If you want to use a calculator, I can sure.
I could just ask over what period of time?
Over a day. If we're looking at 495,000 barrels per day, that would equate to, it's 42 gallons per barrel, correct?
Correct.
So you just multiply 42 by 495,000 and you come up with 20,790,000 gallons, do you not?
So that's the
that
the
would be
line
per day. Yeah, per day. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. And so if we're looking at 2% of that number, you'd be looking at up to 415,800 gallons per day that would be 2% of the pipeline flow rate. Would you agree with that?
Well, subject to actually checking those numbers, yes.
Mr. Hohen just calculated it too. I think he came up with the same number. So if you believe both of us, that would be where that would sound reasonable, wouldn't it? That'd be 2% of that number.
Yep.
Okay. Now in the if the leak a 2% leak was undetected, that amount of product could escape from the pipeline until the leak was detected. Correct.
If the leak went undetected, that amount of pipeline would escape from the pipeline.
That amount of product. I think you said that amount of pipeline.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. Now, in the DNV study, you're familiar with that, are you not?
Yes, I am. Okay.
And in fact, I think I've got in the big notebook there, it says Exhibit C, March 07, right to your left there. That one right there. I've tabbed the most recent DNV study. It's after the big maps. There should be a tab there, at least unless somebody removed it.
Sorry, I don't see Tom.
Okay.
No, I didn't take it out.
That's the I believe the most recent DNV study dated March 28th of 07. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Right.
That study on page 20 has a table labeled 5-2, does it not?
Yes, it does.
And in the DNV study, they were assuming that the threshold level, you've referred to 1.5% to 2%. They just used the number 1.5%, did they not?
They have.
And in their study, they, in Table 20, they indicate that a leak of that magnitude, any of less than 1.5%, could go undetected up to 90 days, correct?
That's what's indicated in the chart, yes.
And if we take the 415,800 gallons times 90 days, we're looking at potentially over 37 million gallons leaking if you use those numbers on that DNV study, correct?
Yes.
In paragraph 15 of your direct testimony. You state that leak detection time thresholds for leaks below the 1.5 to 2% threshold cannot be definitively estimated. Is that right?
That's correct. And that is due to the fact that site-specific circumstances associated with leaks of that size make providing a definitive number impossible.
And you would agree that any sort of computer system like the SCADA system is subject to malfunctions at times?
With the redundancy that Keystone has designed into its SCADA system, I would find it highly unlikely for that to occur.
Unlikely, but certainly possible.
Well, if you're asking, is the probability zero, I can't say the probability is zero.
Paragraph 18 on page 11 of your direct testimony, you reference the emergency response plan. And that is certainly an important part of this project, to get that plan completed. Would you agree with that?
Yes, it is.
And you say it can't be finalized at this point. What needs to be done before that plan can be finalized?
A number of things. The route has to be finalized. The final designs have to be completed. And once all that information is known, then we will perform a worst-case discharge analysis, again, as required by federal codes. It will be very similar to the work that was done in the exhibit provided earlier. We'll look at a fate and transport analysis of where, in fact, any of those spilled volumes may migrate, and then base our plans from that work.
What sort of time frame would we be looking at then for that to be completed?
We intend to have the emergency response plan completed in the first quarter of 2009. That will allow us approximately 9 months to go through the training process with the Keystone employees, contract employees, other potential responders, and have all that in place ahead of actually line-filling the Keystone pipeline.
Take a look at page 18 of that DNV study that you have there. As I read that section, it looks to me like there's three time periods involved in dealing with the leak. First is the detection time, then the verification time, and then isolation. Would you agree with that? Is that the way you would look at dealing with a pipeline leak situation?
Yes, I believe that's reasonable.
Okay. According to your report, paragraph 15.
Your report, paragraph?
Sorry, the direct testimony.
Thank you.
Yeah. The would that reference what's referred to in the DNV study as the detection time?
Yes, it would.
So a leak at the threshold level, which would be anywhere at or above 1.5 to 2%, would be expected to be detected in 140 minutes or less, correct?
That's correct. The larger the leak, the quicker the detection time.
Sure. And then you go on to, again, state that the leaks below that level could remain undetected for time periods longer than 140 minutes, but you don't know exactly how long that would be. Would that be a fair statement?
dependent, again, on site-specific circumstances, it's not feasible to estimate a definitive time for leaks in that very small size range.
Then after the detection time or detection occurs, then there's what's called verification time. What is verification time?
Well, that verification time, I believe if you refer back to the DNV report, that's all part of the detection verification. So in the case here, at item 15 of my direct testimony, there is really no additional time beyond the 140 minutes that would be included in that step. Once the leak detection system detects a leak, the control center procedures will be such that the pipeline will be immediately shut down.
Okay, so paragraph 15 would be both detection and verification then?
That's correct.
Verification would be the time required for the operator to confirm that a leak is occurring and for that operator to decide to take whatever action is appropriate. Is that right?
Sorry, could you restate that?
The verification time would be the time necessary for the operator to confirm that a leak is actually occurring and for him to take the steps necessary to deal with that situation.
In the case of the 25 to 30% limit that by direct observation that I described earlier, your statement is correct.
Okay.
In the case of a leak alarm generated from the leak detection system, once that alarm is received, the operator doesn't take any additional steps. They would immediately, by procedure, shut the pipeline down.
Does that require some human to do that, though, or does it automatically occur?
No, it doesn't automatically occur.
Okay. So somebody has to make the decision to shut the pipeline down when the alarm comes in, or to take the steps to do that.
That's correct.
All right. Does that operator sitting up there in Canada have to consult with anyone before shutting the pipeline down?
No, they certainly do not.
Is there any chance of a false positive on this system where the alarms would go off when there was actually not a leak?
There are occasions where that is, there is some possibility, yes.
So does the operator do anything to attempt to verify whether there really is a leak if the alarms go off?
Yes, they do.
What do they do?
They would review various other informational screens to see whether the data associated is consistent with that would be indicative of a leak.
Okay. So it would be possible for the alarms to go off, the operator to check other data and conclude that it doesn't appear that there is a leak, and in that situation the system would not be shut down.
That's possible, yes. I might just add to that, though. Keystone will employ a very specific time limit for those activities to occur, and that at the conclusion of this time period, a line shutdown would be mandatory.
You don't want to be shutting down the line if there isn't a leak, because that certainly is not a good thing to do economically or otherwise, is it?
Well, it's not a good thing to do economically, certainly, but I would kind of characterize Keystone's procedures as being conservative in that sense, and that a line shutdown would be undertaken if there is that suspicion of a leak.
Then the DNV report talks about isolation time, and that's the time that it takes to isolate the section of the pipe line where the leak is occurring. Is that a fair summary?
Yes.
All right. And that's done by shutting valves and Well, essentially, that's the main thing, is shutting valves, isn't it, and turning off the pipeline?
After the pumping units are stopped, then you would close the isolation valves.
How long does it take to actually close one of the valves?
The valves themselves will have, I think for the most part, electric actuators that will take 3 minutes to physically close.
And I think somewhere we've got where it takes 9 minutes to shut the pumps down. Is that?
That's correct.
Look at paragraph 24 of your direct testimony, please. In that paragraph, which goes on for several pages, you talk about the various steps that are taken to deal with a potential spill. Is that right?
That's correct. Okay.
At the bottom of page 12, you note, upon notification of a potential spill, the Keystone Operations Control Center will perform an emergency pipeline shutdown and close remotely operable isolation valves. That's, again, after that operator has verified that there is actually a leak occurring, correct?
That's correct.
And then you've got the time periods we've already talked about that it takes to shut the pumps and the valves down. Then at the bottom of page 13, you reference the oil spill response plan, and I guess that's the same thing as the emergency response plan that we referenced earlier.
That's correct.
And you note that it's activated by contacting the first responder. Who is the first responder to a potential leak situation? And let's say it's occurring somewhere in South Dakota. Who would the first responder be?
The first responders will be personnel that we have stationed along the pipeline right away that are on call 7x24 to respond in the case of a suspected leak.
As far as South Dakota is concerned, would that be the people in Yankton that would be the first responders?
For that particular area, yes.
And so they would have to travel to the location then where the leak is suspected to be occurring.
Yes, they would.
How many people would we be talking about that would make up the first responder group?
Again, as part of the development of our emergency response plan, we haven't as yet finalized that to be able to give you the exact numbers. Our intent is to have people positioned along the pipeline right away such that we can respond to any location along the right away within 4 hours.
Would somebody in Yankton be able to respond to the entire pipeline area in South Dakota within 4 hours? Do you know?
I would expect not.
So you would expect there'd be somebody else along the route in Yankton that would respond to a leak that might occur in northern South Dakota?
I would expect so, yes.
What sort of person would that be? A Keystone employee or a contract employee?
It could be either.
It's possible there's going to be other Keystone employees stationed somewhere along the line in South Dakota other than just at Yankton?
Yes, it is.
Do you think that's likely, or is that just something that hasn't been determined yet?
Sorry, could you just restate that?
Is it likely there will be other Keystone employees stationed somewhere along the line in South Dakota?
It's likely that there'll be other Keystone either employees or contract people, yes.
Okay. The under the subheading first responder, then moving over to page 14, it mentions the notification of the regional EOC manager and qualified individual. Just so I'm clear on this, Canada would, or the person in Canada would notify the first responder in South Dakota. That would be the first person that would be notified, or first group of people that would be notified.
That's correct.
All right. And then who notifies? Well, is the regional EOC manager and qualified individual, are those two different people, or?
No, the regional EOC manager is the qualified individual.
Okay, all right. And so who notify? Where is the regional EOC manager located?
He would be located at the regional office.
Which is where?
Well, that as well hasn't been determined specifically.
All right. How big of a, typically how big of a region are we talking about? Does it cover several states, or is there going to be one in each state?
I guess it's, I don't have that information at this point in that, you know, we haven't planned at that level of detail.
Who notifies the regional EOC manager?
Typically that notification would come from the Operations Control Center in Calgary.
So if I'd have read the next line, I'd have seen that. So, okay. Then what does the regional EOC manager do?
The regional EOC manager basically activates what we call the regional emergency command center. So he would activate what I'll call remote command center while the a similar command center is activated at the leak site. So we would have a command center located at the leak site, and then we would also have a similar command center activated off-site at the regional office.
And just so I guess so we're clear, EOC refers to Emergency Operations Center?
Yes, it does.
Then it goes on to state that the emergency site manager, who's also a qualified individual, is notified. Now, who is that person?
That person begins with the first responder, and as additional manpower arrives at site, typically a more senior individual would take over as the emergency site manager.
But the first responder would be a qualified individual also?
They are initially, yes.
I assume that just refers to some level of training, is that right?
Well, it refers to the level of training, but it also refers to having the financial authority to necessary to deal with a leak scenario.
Then there's a reference to the corporate EOC manager being contacted. Who is that?
Yes, the corporate EOC is also activated. That center is actually in Calgary, Alberta.
Yeah. And is the corporate EOC manager above the regional EOC manager then as far as the hierarchy is concerned? Or is it different positions?
It's entirely different positions. The intent of the structure is really designed to ensure that the emergency site manager, the personnel that are actually on the site, have the full authority to execute whatever is necessary to deal with the situation. The regional EOC is there to support the site, provide whatever resources are requested from the site, and the corporate EOC in Calgary actually performs a very similar role.
Well, how is their role different? I mean, the regional guy would be on site. What is the corporate EOC manager doing? I mean, he or she doesn't go on site.
No, they do not.
What do they do?
They're there to support the regional EOC as well as the emergency site.
Then the next next bullet says agency contacts, including National Response Center and other state and local agencies are contacted. So the regional EOC manager and the corporate EOC manager are contacted before state and local agencies are contacted?
Well, the regional EOC, once the command center is set up there, that individual is responsible then for the agency notifications.
The emergency site manager then goes to the site and you indicate first responders relieved. So the emergency site manager then at that point, I think as you indicated previously, takes over the on-site cleanup or whatever has to be done.
That's correct. All right. Yep.
Will the location of the EOC manager, the regional EOC manager, that sort of thing, will that all be part of the finalization of the emergency response plan?
Yes, it will.
Look at paragraph 25 on page 16, and this talks about the expected response time for a spill at the farthest point in South Dakota. And it, so let's turn to page 17. Well, I think you told me previously that the Your goal is to have a maximum response time anywhere in the pipeline of 4 hours, right?
For the first responders.
Yeah. Okay. Then you've got a table then on page 17. Explain what that that's talking about a 6 hour, 12 hour time response for 6 hours for high volume area, 12 hours for all other areas for tier one resources. First of all, what are tier one resources?
Tier one resources are, described in various areas, either further on in my testimony or elsewhere. But basically, the tier one resources are those resources that would arrive at site and basically commence cleanup and repair activities.
Would that be the first responders that we?
No. Okay. The first responders arrive within the 4 hours.
All right, they'd be there first, and then the tier one resources would arrive later.
Would follow, yes.
Okay. And if there was a leak, would the first responders be capable of stopping that leak? Or would the leak potentially continue until the tier one resource people got there?
It depends on the site specific circumstances. The first responders certainly don't arrive with any heavy equipment and so on, but they are capable of performing some containment activities.
Okay. But the actual people that would commence to, if necessary, to dig up the pipeline and repair a leak would be included in the tier one resources?
That's correct.
All right. And so for the response time for them, in a high volume area, which you've defined as a major river crossing or, well, I guess that's primarily what you're defining there is the high volume area, is that right?
Well, it's actually not me defining it.
I'm sorry.
That's basically a clause directly out of 49 CFR 194.115.
Okay. But in any event, would there be anywhere in South Dakota other than the Yankton area, which would be considered a high-volume area?
Not to my knowledge.
All right. So anywhere else, anywhere other than the Yankton area, the Code of Federal Regulations requires that the Tier 1 resources must be there within 12 hours.
That's correct.
And Keystone would intend to, well, as you say, would meet or exceed those requirements.
That's correct. That again, you know, when we're developing our emergency response plan, you know, we will ensure we meet those requirements. You know, those are at the bounds of travel, so to speak. So depending on the location of the leak, Tier 1 resources could arrive certainly sooner than the 12, but no later.
Sure. And that will be a factor as to where you have your various resources, which will all be part of the emergency response plan that's being developed.
That's correct.
And then Tier 2 and Tier 3 resources are just additional people or equipment that's needed to complete whatever needs to be completed to deal with the situation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Look at page 23 under question 30. In the second paragraph under that question, you know it, in the unlikely event of a fire associated with the pipeline rupture. Again, although unlikely, fires do occur in connection with crude oil pipeline ruptures, do they not?
I'm sorry, could you say
fires that? Do occur in connection with the crude oil pipeline ruptures at times?
Well, I guess they have occurred, yes.
Okay. Okay, let's move on to your rebuttal testimony then. Paragraph 6, at the bottom of the page, and on page 3 and then going on to page 4, you note that in your opinion the DNV assumptions were overly conservative? Is that your opinion?
Yes.
Now, DNV is a well-known risk management company that deals with pipelines. Is that right?
That's my understanding.
And are you familiar with DNV?
In what sense?
Well, have you seen their work before? Are they well recognized in the industry?
I assume so. I guess I can't.
Well, have you worked on pipelines like this previously?
Yes.
Have you been familiar with DNV being used by?
I can't say that I've been associated with DNV prior to this.
Okay. Did you have any direct involvement with the preparation of the DNV report?
To some extent, yes.
Okay. If you want to turn to the second page, it's not page 2, it's the page after the cover page. That indicates that, I believe it says the client reference is Ms. Kothari, is that right?
I see that.
Okay. And DNV was hired by Keystone to perform this analysis?
Yes.
Right. So I assume Keystone wouldn't hire a company that was not reputable, would they?
Be my assumption as well.
Okay. That report indicates that it was prepared by someone named Bjorn Nilberg, was a principal consultant, was verified by another principal consultant named Cheryl Stahl, and a senior administrative assistant named Susan Norman, and then was approved by David Weimer, the upstream market sector leader. Are you familiar with any of those people?
I'm familiar with Bjorn Nielberg.
Right. And that's the individual who put together the report itself, or primarily was responsible, is that right?
I see he's listed as having prepared by.
Okay. Did you, there's been at least one other draft of the report that we talked about yesterday. Is the reports, and I don't know if there were other ones, there may have been, but did you review the drafts as they were being prepared before this version that we're looking at, which I believe is the most recent version, was signed by everyone?
Yes, I've reviewed, I wouldn't say thoroughly, but I've certainly seen and reviewed certain areas of them, yes.
Did you ask that any of the drafts be changed because you felt that they were overly conservative?
No.
Paragraph 9 of your rebuttal testimony responds to, I'll let you find that. You have that?
Yes, I do.
It responds to a comment or some pre-filed testimony by a Mr. Hannon, who is one of the staff's experts in this case, who indicated that he believes the study should be revised to better account for the likelihood of damage to the pipeline caused by excavation activities. And your response to that is that Keystone did not include any sort of risk associated with agricultural resources such as plowing and tilling. Is that right?
Due to the depth of burial of 48 inches, as they indicate.
Okay. How about, was there any analysis with regard to heavy equipment going over the top of the pipeline? Any potential that could be caused by that? Potential damage that could be caused by that?
I'm sorry, could you...
Was there any analysis of the risk of heavy equipment being driven over the top of the pipeline?
I guess I'm not intimately familiar with the exact details of the analysis. It would certainly be my assumption that there was an analysis done.
That there was?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thomas. That's all I have.
Do you want to jump right in, Mr. Hone, or would the commissioners like to have a short break or proceed? Little break?
Sure.
Why don't we?
I could go another 20 minutes, but I don't know how
long. Well, it's a break here. It's breaking point, so why don't we, what do you think, until a quarter two?
That would be fine.
Until a quarter two. Thank you. Are you ready, Sherry? We're back in session following a short break. Brian Thomas is still on the witness stand, and Mr. Hone, you may begin your cross-examination.
Good morning, Mr. Thomas.
Good morning.
On page 1 of your direct testimony, you, second item, you state that you're the president of Briwest Energy LTD, and you're consulting with TransCanada, is that correct?
Well, it is Keystone, yes.
I'm sorry.
That's correct.
Item 3 then refers to your position with Keystone as coordinator oil movement. Are you performing that task as a contracted party or a direct employee?
Well, as 2 indicates that I'm providing consulting services, so I am a contract employee.
But as with the title, you said your position with Keystone is coordinator of oil movement. Are you? Do you have full authority of for that task, or do you report to someone?
Well, I certainly report to someone.
And who would that be?
Mr. Jones.
Robert Jones. And do you work out of the Operations Control Center?
I work out of the Calgary office. Okay.
And I assume you will be, based on this testimony in item 3, you'll be coordinating or in charge of the emergency response plan development?
Yes, I will be overseeing the development of the emergency response plan.
You mentioned this just briefly in response to Mr. Rasmussen, but could you summarize and I know it's attached, but could you summarize for the hearing your background in oil pipeline operations and oil movement, your experience?
Well, I've have approximately 27 years in the pipeline business. 25 of that was with another pipeline company where I was involved in similar types of activities, involvement within the Operations Control Center and various field positions at operating facilities and terminals.
And could you list a couple of examples of companies you've worked for in that capacity?
There was just a single one.
And that was?
That was Enbridge.
Enbridge?
Enbridge, correct.
Okay, thank you. And what pipelines, when you work with Enbridge, what pipelines did you manage in that capacity, or the oil flow did you manage? Which directions, what lines, if you could summarize?
Well, when I was involved with the control center, it was the lines from Edmonton to Superior, Wisconsin. One of the lines from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario, and an additional line that ran from Norman Wells, Northwest Territories, down to Zama Lake, Alberta.
On the bottom of page 2, item 8.
Sorry?
On the bottom of page 2 of your direct testimony, it's question 8, and then I think your response number 1, I, sub I. Unintended closure of valves and shutdowns. What would be the nature of an unintended closure? What is an example of an unintended closure?
An unintended closure would be some sort of equipment malfunction or breakdown that would close a valve without it being commanded to close from the Operations Control Center.
And that's listed as an abnormal operation under the federal code, apparently because it happens from time to time?
It's been known to happen, yes.
The top of the next page, 3, the next item, I guess it would be I2, increase or decrease in pressure or flow. Explain what would cause an increase and then what would cause a decrease in pressure and flow.
I guess one example of that may be a leak where the flow rate may increase as a result of the leak. And so the flow rate on the upstream side of the leak may increase while the flow rate on the downstream side of the leak may decrease.
Would a pump malfunction cause an increase?
An increase in flow?
Could a pump malfunction cause an increase in pressure flow?
Re- Could you rephrase that, please?
Could the malfunction of a pump station or a pump in a pump station result in an increase in pressure and flow, an abnormal increase?
I guess it's possible. It's more likely it would result in a decrease. But
on the suction side, there'd be a decrease, but would there be an increase on the discharge side?
In what circumstance?
If a pump malfunctioned and went beyond the control parameters of how you normally operate.
Well, there'd have to be a number of failures of control systems for that to occur, because there are redundant levels of protection to prevent that.
I understand, but could, if those things all lined up, the stars lined up, could a pump cause an increase in pressure and flow?
Well, if you were to consider double and triple jeopardy, I guess at some point you could get there.
Okay. The next item then there, next is the, I guess it's a triple I note, loss of communication. When we say communication, are we talking SCADA communication?
That would be my understanding, yes.
And how would loss of SCADA communication occur in your experience?
Well, I'm not quite sure of your question. How would it occur?
This says one of the things that they want, that the federal code requires or assumes could happen, is loss of SCADA communication. And so there must be, you must have examples or know of examples of where SCADA communication hasn't been continuous.
Yet, dependent upon your communication system, if you're using a telephone, for example, you could lose that telephone connection to a given pump facility.
That won't happen in our state. We have an excellent PUC. No, seriously. What is your communication system? Could you describe how the SCADA communicates with a point from Alberta to South Dakota?
I guess we haven't finalized that design, but we expect at this point that it will be actually a satellite system. So we will have satellite dishes located at each of the facilities that will in turn communicate to the Calgary Control Center.
Have you used satellite communication in other projects?
Yes, I have.
And is there a reliability factor on that kind of communication?
Well, certainly.
What is the connection success rate on satellite?
Well, I think most of the satellite providers will tell you it's 99.9-something. We will have a redundant form of communication as well, such that if satellite communication is lost to a single pump station, we would have some kind of a backup system.
Based on your knowledge of this project design so far, what do you believe, or what do you think the redundant system might be, the backup?
I would expect it would be a telephone service provider.
Okay. The very bottom of that section, just before item two, or personnel error, which could cause a hazard to persons or property. What, in your experience, what are some of the likely or possible personnel errors that might occur?
I'm sorry, could you just point out that section?
It's the 1, 2, 3, 4 section from the top of page 3. Any other malfunction of a component, deviation from normal operation, or personnel error. What kinds of personnel error, or man-made, or I assume it's an operator error. Is that what that's saying?
Well, I guess it whether it's an operator, within the OCC or located at a field facility, it would apply.
What kind of error might that be from your experience? What are some examples, I guess?
An example might be a closed valve.
Okay. Would it be somebody shutting something off to do maintenance and then forgetting to turn it back on?
No, because the way Keystone would operate is that the shutdown of any equipment when we're talking pumping facilities will be done from the control center. Personnel locally would not be be turning off or stopping any equipment without that being controlled from the control center.
Let me ask it another way. If you had, you have, I believe Mr. Jones testified there'd be three personnel stationed at Yankton, and as I recall, two were electrical technicians and one was a pipe operator. Those would be TransCanada employees from what he said. If the electrician went to a pump station at Raymond, for example, and was going to do work on the pump station to check it or maintain, he may need to turn things off before he worked on it and then turn them back on. Is that, would you say that's correct?
Could you define things?
Equipment at the pump station, control equipment, electrical equipment. Before he worked on it, he might have to shut something off.
Well, I don't want to leave you with the impression that the technicians turn things off without the without that being done from the control center. So the control center, if there was a need to stop pumping facilities at a given pump station to allow a technician to do work, that would be performed by the operator in Calgary.
And so the, let me see if I understand how that might work. Would the electrician then that arrives at the site to do maintenance radio the control center and say, I need to work on this pump, can you shut it off? Is that how that would work?
That's how it would work, although he wouldn't likely radio them.
Okay. You mentioned that you'd have personnel working 7/24. I assume that's 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Could you refer me to a clause?
Well, no, you were referring to your control center, and you said you'd have the system would be monitored, and there'd be people watching the system 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Is that?
That's correct. The control center, the operations control center in Calgary will be manned 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
The way you were saying is a little different than we say it here, and I misunderstood, I think,
okay,
what you said. The operations personnel, then, that would be full-time employees at Yankton, for example, three personnel that Mr. Jones mentioned, are they on call 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or do they have shifts where they're on call?
Keystone will have a complement of people and basically maintain an on-call, what I would call term a roster of people that are on call 7/24.
So they would take turns, is that?
That would be reasonable, yes.
On page 7, item 10, it's the third bullet of your answer, response. Additional automated features installed at the local pump station level will also utilize to provide pipeline pressure protection in the event of communication with the SCADA system are lost or are interrupted. What are the additional features?
Well, I guess one would certainly be a pressure reduction or line pressures in the event communications are lost at a given pump station would be automatically driven down at that particular location such that there would be no potential to overpressure the pipeline at any point downstream of the pump station.
So what would be performing that function? Is there a controller on site or is it the control computer at Alberta?
Well, it's driven down locally because you're without communication with the host system in Calgary. So the local system will know that it's not in communication with the central host in Calgary and as a result of that will drive down to these safe limits that I described.
So it's set, there's a small computer at the pump station that if it couldn't communicate with the control center would then go to an operational mode that might diminish pressure and flow.
That's correct. There are a number of what I'll call PLCs or programmable logic controllers at the pump station facilities.
Would that be referred to as an RTU?
No. An RTU is commonly known as a remote terminal unit and typically utilized to speak directly with the host computer. So you would, in a architectural arrangement that involves an RTU, you would have several of these PLCs that in turn speak to the RTU, which in turn speaks to the host.
But the PLC on site could operate if it couldn't, all by itself, if it couldn't communicate with central for some reason.
I'm sorry, it could operate.
The automated feature is then located in a PLC, a local computer that can operate by itself without communicating to central.
That's correct. It senses a loss of communication with the host and then executes its function.
On the top of page 10, bottom of the first paragraph of your testimony, referring to small leaks, reported to the OCC by direct observation methods. Who does that function? Who performs that task?
Well, I think I've listed them there, including aerial patrol, employee, contractor, or other third-party observation.
In your previous testimony to Mr. Rasmussen, you mentioned that there, in addition to the three people stationed at Yankton, there could be others up and down the pipeline in South Dakota. Would those be contract employees?
They could be either.
So is it possible it could be a part-time contract employee who might drive the route for you above and beyond the aerial flights?
It's possible, yes.
Particularly if you're looking for a leak?
Well, particularly if we're looking for a leak, yes.
The third-party observation would be adjacent landowners?
That would be one example, yes.
Somebody driving by, maybe?
Yes.
The top of page 12, excuse me, you're referring to Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 personnel or crews, and you list training. I assume any part-time employee would have to have that training to perform tasks for leak detection?
Yes, whether it's employee, contractor, or otherwise. All are provided with the same level of training.
And is that required under the federal regulation?
It is.
What's the purpose of that training? If they're not cleaning the leak up, what is the purpose of a training, let's say, of an observer, somebody driving the line looking for leaks? Why would that person need the training?
Sorry, could you rephrase that?
Sure. Let's say you've contracted with somebody local, a retired farmer in the Andover area, to serve as one of your spotters in the event of you think you might have a leak. That retired farmer, who's a part-time employee, gets a call and is asked to drive a certain route of the pipe. to look for a leak? Does he need, does that he or she need a Tier 1 8 HAZWOP training?
Well, no, actually the training is more fully described elsewhere. So basically, the training that's provided is consistent with the responsibilities that one might have.
So could you summarize then the difference between the training you'd have at Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3? I assume some of these people are doing direct handling of the material and some are not.
Is that those resources, Tier 1, 2, and 3, are involved in cleanup and repair activities. So.
Okay, thank you. On page 14, you refer to the various levels of response. It starts on 13 and goes to 14, the first response, and then regional and emergency site management. From the start of the first responder to a crew being on site to start the cleanup, in your experience, what is the total time needed from first response, first notification, to having boots on the ground doing the cleanup work? I realize it's based on a distance, but I'll give you an example.
If you'd let him answer, I'd appreciate it. He was prepared to answer your question.
Yes.
I guess it's certainly been my experience that as I testified to earlier, the 4 hours to have a first responder on site and an additional 12 to have our Tier 1 resources, in many instances, one is able to do a lot better than that.
Let me give you an example. Let's just assume there's a leak or a suspected leak near Britain. And the Britain, South Dakota, and your team, you have a group of three people in Yankton. Can you meet the four-hour response time from Yankton to Britain?
I guess depending on the conditions, in many instances, maybe not.
Conditions meaning driving conditions?
Driving conditions and such.
They would respond with a vehicle. They'd take a vehicle, not a plane.
No,
or...
I guess it depends. Would depend certainly upon the circumstances. The plan, the emergency response or oil spill response plan, once it's fully developed, will ensure that those capabilities that I quoted in terms of response times are I guess completed, able that we're able to. Meet that measure.
So if in developing the emergency response plan, you're going to do that after the pipeline is built or under construction, is that correct?
Well, it'll be done while the pipeline, some parts of the pipeline are being constructed. It will be completed, though, a year in advance of commencing line fill activities.
If you, in developing that plan, if you found that you couldn't respond in 4 hours to the furthest distance away from your center, what action would you take to modify the plan?
I guess there'd be a number of different things that you could do. Potentially look at additional people, look at additional modes of transportation, and consider what might be best.
Okay. On the bottom of page 14, second line from the bottom, you're talking about, it says, this is typically accomplished primarily with containment booms and berms. Could you describe what a boom and a berm is and how it's used in an emergency response?
Well, that particular section is talking about containment within a waterway. And basically describing the, I guess, the primary forms of containment and recovery, that being containment booms that allow you to contain an oil spill that may be on water and recover the associated spilled volume.
Then going to the next page in that same section, second paragraph, second line, I guess, with the approval of authorities having jurisdiction, activities such as ditch digging and building berms would be undertaken on the downslope of the spill. Is the intent of that to block the oil from reaching a drainage?
A drainage or water body. To, in fact, contain volume such that they're easier to deal with.
Would TransCanada have an easement on that property, or if you didn't have an easement on that property, what activity would be taken? If you needed to get on property to
make arrangements with the
Well, for example, if the oil reached a county or state road ditch, you'd talk to those officials before you put a berm in?
We'd be in conversation with them, and I'm sure they'd give us a blanket approval to allow us to do something like that.
By that point in time, they'd be out in the field with you? Is that what you're
saying? I would suspect. In many cases, they would.
The next paragraph, then, it says, to contain the spill product once it has reached the waterway, efforts are typically directed toward the deployment of containment booms and as close as practical and safe downstream of the spill location. That's got to, I'm assuming that it's a case-by-case basis. Would that be fair to say?
It would be. We will have, as part of our response plan, pre-identified what I'll refer to as control points that would be on waterways located downstream of the pipeline, such that based on the flow speed or flow of the river at a particular time, we would be able to determine whether a control point located 5 miles, 10 miles, or 15 miles downstream would be the most appropriate place to deploy boom.
And along that line, what mapping resources would your field people have and your command center have in terms of knowing where you are in relation to the pipeline and how you might respond? You'd be looking at maps and data to try to organize your team, correct?
Well, no, we wouldn't be trying to organize the team because that was all pre-done ahead of time. The maps, drawings, et cetera, control points are all identified beforehand such that we're aware of roads to provide access and such to get to a specific control point.
Could I ask you if you could find there on the table a TC-16? I believe it was available there yesterday. It looks something like this. Mr. Thomas, do you have TC-16 there with you?
I have.
Thank you. I'd like to just for a minute divert or look at another document you gave us here this morning, I assume, TC-20. Is the graph that was...
Okay. I have that.
Okay. If you're looking at the bottom of that graph, there are the numbers 4, 16, 29, 40. I assume those are miles.
That's correct.
From the North Dakota border coming south?
Correct.
Okay. And so to correspond with where we are on the map page, we would have to add 218 to that number, I assume, because that's the number right at the state line. Would that be correct?
That's correct.
Okay. I'm going to refer to your numbers on this graph, and I may mention also what I think the map page number is, because it relates to this map we're looking at, TC16.
Okay.
As I understand this graph, it shows on the left side there are calculated spill volume in barrels, and the first point or peak at the top part of that graph starts at 15,000 barrels and then climbs somewhere up between 15 and 20, correct?
That's correct.
So that would be, because of the that given location, I assume that's is that a high point of spill, risk or spill risk?
Well, it's not a high, risk is not really associated with this. This is specifically volume, so that, the reason for the higher volume at that point would be a combination of valve location and elevation profile.
Would it also have something to do with proximity to the nearest pump station?
Very little to do with proximity to the nearest pump station.
Thank you for clarifying that. If we could look then to, on the graph it's 16, and I believe on the TC16 it's two. It's map point 234. And do you see that on T16?
Milepost 234, I see, yes.
Yes. And that would be 2 miles east and about a mile and a half south of the town of Amherst, wouldn't it, according to that TC16? The line running diagonal, the railroad line crosses right through Amherst, small town of Amherst, on TC16.
Yes, I see it.
Okay. So on the graph, 16 is milepost, or is that what you refer to it as, milepost?
Yes, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay, milepost 234. That is a point of a potential high spill volume if there were a failure there?
Assuming you've corrected with respect to the scales, yes.
Okay. If you look then to the next, again, we're looking at TC20, and it would be mile 128. And there's a point there of spill volume, a large spill volume potential, the top part of the graph. And that, if I'm doing this correctly, and if I'm not, correct me, but that would appear to be milepost 344. And that would be on map page 6 of TC16. You see that? Milepost 344?
Yes, I do.
And that would be, based on the map, TC16, about 3 miles west and a mile south of Carthage.
Right? Yes, correct.
Okay. I'm going to come back with questions on each, but I'd like to point the other two out, and then we'll come back with the follow-up question. If you go to then mile 177, we're at map page or milepost 395, which is page 8 of TC16. And that appears to be about 6 miles south of the Hutchinson County line. Along Wolf Creek, according to TC16. And then the last one I'd like to draw your attention to, and we'll talk about all four of them because they're all related. The last item I'd like to ask you about, refer you to, is 204, which is mile 204 in the graph. And on the map, it is milepost 422 on page 10 of TC 16, which is about 13 miles north of Yankton, South Dakota. See that?
Yes, I do.
Let's start with, we'll go backwards on TC 16, but milepost 22 where the pipe is at that location, immediately to the west of that point, milepost 422, there's the James River, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so at that point, milepost 422, which is about, looks like maybe about a mile or half a mile from the river, that's one of the high points, a high point in your graph for showing spill volume.
Yes.
Okay. Let's go back then to page, or map post 395, which is map page 8 on TC 16. And there are tributaries and streams near that location. It appears based on TC 16 page 8. That's the a creek, Wolf Creek, which appears to be a tributary of the James River. Is that correct?
Well, I see Wolf Creek. I'm not entirely familiar that it's a tributary of the James River.
I think the next map page 9 shows it connecting. Mm-hmm. Let's go to page 344 then. Again, on TC 16, it would be...
Page or milepost?
Milepost 344, and it's page 6 of TC 16, near Carthage. And that milepost, that point is close to a creek. It appears to be, from this map, your exhibit... I don't know if the creek is labeled or identified.
Is there a question coming?
The question is this. When you develop your plan for emergency response, and you stated earlier, you wouldn't be doing it in the field. You'd have a plan in advance. Is that correct? Emergency response plan.
I'm sorry. We wouldn't be doing it in the field?
Well, I ask you when you would do your plan, and you said that you do these plans, you have a plan put together for emergency response and spill containment all along the pipeline route, depending upon what you're crossing. That's what I guess I heard. Is that correct?
Yes, that's pre-done.
Pre-done, prior to operation of the pipeline.
Correct.
So on these four sites, if you were looking at the one, for example, on map page 6, TC 16, would you develop a plan in the event that there was a spill at that location, to contain the oil from going where?
Well, what we'll do as part of the development of the oil spill response plan is now take this data that we've provided here under TC20 and do what we call a transport and fate analysis. And base that analysis then looks at each, again, milepost along the pipeline right away, what the transport and fate of these volumes will be, and based upon that analysis, we'll develop our plan for resources, equipment, et cetera.
And what would that analysis, that fate analysis, take into account? What factors?
Well, it takes into account the overland or overwater transfer of spilled oil.
Okay, next, following along then on page 15 of your direct testimony, it's the second paragraph from the bottom, second line. You refer to mechanical skimming, vacuum recovery, and sorbent materials. Could you explain what those items are and how they're used?
Well, mechanical skimming is done as part of a boom, typically, where the oil spill containment boom channels oil that may be on the surface of water into a skimmer that in turn basically separates the water and oil and allows you to transfer that oil to other facilities. Vacuum recovery is typically employed with something that's called a vacuum truck. So it actually provides or has a suction capability that allows one to suck liquid, including oil. The last was sorbent, and that's typically a material that would be similar to a sponge that's able to absorb and contain spilled oil in this case.
The skimmer then is a device that'll pull the oil out of the water and then let the water go back into the waterway? Is that what it does?
It really what the skimmer does is it takes the water, or excuse me, the oil off the surface of the oil, puts it into a small little holding facility that then is transferred to other facilities.
And the Vector truck, is that a large truck or small truck? Is it a large piece of equipment?
They're a combination of different sized vacuum trucks. It's typically a tandem axle truck.
Tandem. The next paragraph, second line, the methods include wiping, hot water, low pressure or high pressure wash, and the use of surfactants and emulsifiers or other agents. Could you explain what those last two items are?
They're very much the same, but they allow easier cleaning of oil by breaking down its constituents.
And that, I assume, is a product that's environmentally safe in terms of using it in doing a cleanup and not damaging the environment?
That's correct. There are certain types.
Okay. The next page, then, 16, second paragraph, the product-laden soils are typically either removed or treated with bioremediation in the event of such intrusion. Cleanup techniques are not appropriate. By product, do you mean the crude oil?
That's correct.
And removed or treated with bioremediation. Could you describe bioremediation?
Well, I think I had earlier, but bioremediation in this case means typically tillage, cultivation of soils, the addition of fertilizers, and those fertilizers supplemented with oxygen, as I understand it, allow microorganisms to grow and basically degrade the hydrocarbons.
So would that be done on site in the event there was a spill, let's say, in a farm field? Would that work all be done at that site?
Yes, it would.
Would the soil ever be hauled away and treated?
In certain cases, I guess it could be. Again, in the event of a spill such as that, the cleanup plan is done in conjunction with federal, state, and the landowner, so that the methodology that's chosen reflects the concerns of all those involved.
On the very next line of that paragraph, there's reference to burning. Is burning an option for removal of oil? And where is that done?
Excuse me, could you just point me to the reference?
1, 2, 3, 4. It's the fifth line down. It's in that second paragraph. The sentence starts out, up including natural recovery, comma, burning, comma. On page 16. Am I on the wrong page?
Yeah, no, I see it here. Yes, like burning, again, based upon, federal, state, and others, is something that is considered in the event of an oil spill. It certainly requires the necessary permits, but is often used as quite an effective means for the very little amount of residual oil that is potentially covering the surface. Once all the freestanding oil has been picked up by vacuum trucks and other means. There still remains, you know, a slight amount of oil that can't be picked up by those methodologies, and burning can be considered as a means to clean that portion.
So what you're saying in your testimony is it wouldn't be the primary method of removal. You would try to remove as much as you could?
That's correct. If it's only done after you've removed as much as can be removed, that's what I'll call kind of freestanding, so to speak. And it's, you know, certainly done in a controlled fashion with all the appropriate permits in place.
Does that have any negative effect on the soil if you burn the oil off to the residual?
Well, I'm not an expert in that area.
Okay. On the bottom of page 16, the very last bullet talks about dispatch, first responders, and how does your team or this emergency group that's going to respond to this, how do they communicate in the field given, how do they communicate? What systems do they use?
Well, a combination of cellular phones, backed up with satellite phones, and to some extent, two-way radios.
Let's take the two-way radio first. I guess your two-way radio would be from truck to truck?
Well, that's more site, yeah, person to person, that sort of thing.
Would you have radio towers in South Dakota?
No, I don't expect we will.
Okay. And then the satellite phone, is that, does every person involved in the team have one of those?
Yes, all personnel on the response teams have satellite phones.
And that would allow them to get a phone line from anywhere?
That's my understanding.
Okay. And the cell phone would be a backup?
Well, I guess I'd probably go the other way around. That it would be cell phone first, backed up by satellite. But in any event, they have both forms.
And so in an area where we didn't have cell phone coverage along this pipeline route, the satellite would be the assured connection. Give you sure connection?
Yes.
Okay. On page 17, the graph required by 49 CFR Part 194, the response, the Tier 1, 2, and 3, does that take into account travel conditions such as icy roads and winter travel and so forth?
It does.
And if you are not, well, I guess, let me ask the question. If the roads were so icy that you couldn't travel 60 miles an hour, you were traveling less than that, 30 miles an hour, are you given an exception because of weather if you have difficulty getting there in terms of time limit?
No, tables, as required by code, are inclusive of conditions such as inclement weather.
So just so I understand it correctly, the Tier 3 resources would have, in our area, this project in South Dakota, would they have 54 hours or 60 hours to get there?
Well, other than the high-volume areas, they would have 60 hours. The Tier 3 resources, you know, would only as well be called in if that were necessary. This system is one that I would call escalating in nature, such that the emergency site manager has access, again through the regional EOC, to call in the resources as necessary. They would start first with Tier 1. If it was determined additional resources were needed, they'd move to Tier 2 and to Tier 3 beyond that if it were necessary.
In the chart, there's an asterisk next to high volume area, and then below the chart, it refers to having a nominal outside diameter of 20 inches. This pipe is 30 inches, correct?
Yes.
So what does that mean in terms of the response time for this pipeline in South Dakota? Are we looking at Tier 3 at 54 hours or 60? It's not clear to me.
Well, basically what this chart indicates is that within a high volume area, such as those described, you have to meet the high volume area requirement of 54 hours. If it's not considered a high volume area as defined, then you meet the 60 hours.
And would this pipeline through South Dakota meet the high volume?
I don't, other than the Missouri River, I do not believe it would.
The Tier 3 resources, would those normally be located in South Dakota, or are they brought in as a contract equipment provider?
Well, I guess that, as I mentioned earlier, we have not defined as yet as to whether they'll be contract, where they'll be located, has yet to be determined.
Okay, thank you. On the next page, 18 of your direct testimony, the second paragraph, third line, you see that there?
Yes, I do.
The sentence starts out, ecological, historical, archaeological resources, and drinking water locations. In the context of that paragraph, the task of Tier 1 response is to minimize the spread of product, and there's reference to drinking water locations. As a person who operates the pipe and will be in charge of developing an emergency response plan, what does drinking water location mean to you?
Drinking water locations here was used in the context of the federal codes that have been discussed at length here at these proceedings.
The sentence just above that refers to protecting the public in unusually sensitive areas. And then in the next line, it refers to drinking water location. How does your crew in the field, your emergency team, identify a drinking water location they're going to need to protect?
They're identified as part of the emergency response plan.
I guess, would you be referencing public records as to knowing which well or which water source or which facility to protect and which you wouldn't have a responsibility to protect?
I'm sorry, could you rephrase that?
Would you what information would you resource, what listing would you reference to know which water, drinking water locations you would protect as part of your emergency plan?
Well, I guess we would, I'm not familiar with like the specific names. We would, utilize the best data we were able to discover with respect to those items.
You were here yesterday, were you, and observed Ms. Tilquist's testimony?
Yes, I was here.
Were you here when she discussed highly consequential areas?
Yes, I was.
I guess I'm trying to understand the connection between this paragraph and her testimony as to whether a water system, what kinds of water systems might be included in your protection plan. Her statement, she referred to highly consequential areas and said rural water systems weren't referenced. I guess I'm wondering, does this plan provide protection for drinking water locations?
Are you representing Webb Water now or Kurt Holm, the intervener?
I'm asking a question as a citizen of the state. Drinking water systems protected?
Commissioners, we've heard from Webb Water's counsel on this. He's had ample opportunity to cross-examine the witness.
Well, I think the other thing, it's a misstatement of the record, in my view. But if you're talking about water, drinking, rural water source areas,
yes.
That's not what she testified to. But
I guess what I'm trying to determine, Mr. Smith, from this witness is on his testimony, page 18, where he references drinking water locations and this emergency response plan will provide protection. I'm wondering what protection, how they would go about that and knowing which ones to protect.
May I, you mentioned, what is that? Oh. You mentioned fate and transport and fate analysis. Might that be the direction you want to go with this?
Well, yes, certainly that, I guess, that analysis will the transport and fate analysis will tell us where a potential spill may migrate, and it's basically then a case where you look at what facilities may be impacted as a result of where this oil, potential spilled oil may migrate.
Page 19, item 27. The bottom of the last sentence in the first paragraph there under 27. Consequently, emergency responders will be based in close proximity to the following areas. Do you see that?
Correct. Yes, I do.
And then if you'd look at the third bullet, where it starts out, unusually sensitive areas, including drinking water locations, are referenced. My question there, I guess, is, and you mentioned, you alluded to this a bit earlier, would you locate your resources and develop a plan based on the proximity of drinking water locations, among other things?
Among other things, yes. That's the intent here, is that, you know, typically your responders would be located in closer proximity, as I've indicated, to those items.
Okay. Thank you. Page 22, if you'd want to turn to page 22 of your direct testimony. The second bullet from the bottom refers to personal protective equipment, rubber gloves, waders. Do you see that there?
Yes, I see that.
And the second line, and H2S, O2, LEL, and benzene detection equipment. Do you see that?
I do.
Could you explain to us what is meant there, what that equipment is and how it's used in a cleanup?
Well, that equipment is utilized by response personnel that are in, I won't say direct contact, but are, you know, engaged in cleanup activities. And in order to ensure their personal protection, this equipment is available to them.
What is the H2S equipment?
Hydrogen sulfide. So it's a basically a instrument that is capable of detecting levels of hydrogen sulfide.
Okay, and the O2?
That's oxygen.
It's bottles of oxygen. Is that what you're referring
to? No, that would detect a deficiency of oxygen.
So it's a detector then?
Yes, it's basically it's a three-head detector that is capable of detecting levels of H2S, deficiencies of oxygen, and lower explosive limit.
Okay. And then the LEL?
That's the lower explosive limit.
Lower explosive limit, okay. The last bullet there, a windsock. Is there a reason you have a windsock in a job like this? What's the reason, I guess?
Well, you have a windsock so you can determine the direction of the wind and typically work on the upwind side.
I see. I believe that's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Do other interveners have questions that haven't already been addressed, asked? Mr. Miller, please. Yeah, thank you. I realize, too, for the benefit of people in the audience, interveners who had time scheduled, if anyone has an urgency to, we scheduled you, so if you have an urgency to go right then. Otherwise, it was maybe our thought we would proceed with Mr. Thomas and try to get him done. So you'll have to let us know if you have to get going, and we'll put you up at any time. Is that okay? I know, John, you're one of them, and Ms. Anderson. What do you think, Ms. Anderson? Should we plow ahead and get him done and then? Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr.
Sorry
Miller.
For the interruption.
That's fine. Mr. Thomas, you worked for Enbridge for 20 or 25 years. Is that correct?
Yes, I did.
And one of your primary responsibilities was to transport crude between Alberta and Superior, Wisconsin. Is that correct?
Yes, I worked in association with those pipelines.
Can you tell me how many multi-million gallon spills Enbridge had while you were an employee there?
No, I can't. I've not added things up, so to speak.
Are you aware of any?
Any spills?
Any multi-million gallon spills?
Well, I guess that's not a terminology that I'm accustomed in working in gallons.
Okay.
I am aware of some large spills that Enbridge had.
Are you aware of any that were... there were 25,000 barrels or more?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, could you give me an example?
I believe the, what I'll refer to as the Grand Rapids spill was greater than that.
Okay. And are you familiar with any of those spills of that size that would have been in the United States?
Yes, that was in the United States.
Oh, excuse me. Any of, of that size that were in Canada?
I'm familiar with some others.
Could you give me an example of one of those?
I'm familiar with one that occurred in close proximity to Regina, Saskatchewan.
All right, thank you. Another question is referring to the frequency volume study from DNV, in section 5.5, there were various source control measures that were put in or assumed to be put in place. That would be on page 22
Mr. Miller, to which version are you referring?
That would be the May 06 version is the page number that I had.
And I'm sorry, could you give me that reference again?
It would be page 22, section 5.5.
I think you've got a different version there. You've got the March 07.
I don't know if we need to refer to it specifically. I had a question. There was an assumption in there that you would be able to control all small and medium leaks anywhere within the pipeline within 4 hours, including location and excavation, clamping or gel block. Would you say that's a reasonable assumption,
Mr. Miller? What are you looking at? We're trying to find. You're looking at
that was in the May 6 version, May 2006 version of the frequency volume study.
Where
it was section 5.5, which was on page 22 of that version.
Thank you.
Well, and I guess with respect to that question, that is the very reason that we earlier this morning provided TC-20. The DNV study, as per your reference, included only a four-hour response time. As I mentioned, we have revised that to reflect the four-hour response time followed by an additional 12 hours in the case of the medium and small leak volume, and Exhibit TC-20 provides those revised numbers.
Okay, so that it would it would be increased from the 4 hours that were included in that original study. Is that correct to assume that?
That's correct.
Say that? Okay,
yes,
thank you.
It is.
One more question I would have. Regarding the nominal capacity of the pipeline, it's stated at 591,000 barrels a day. In your experience, how often does the pipeline run above the nominal operating capacity?
I guess in my experience, on a annual basis, that is over the course of 365 days of the year, that is likely to be the annual capacity, so that we will be able to achieve that volume again over 365 days of the year. There will be times, small periods of time, maybe 2 to 4 hour periods of time, something in that range, typically in the warmer summer months, where we may be able to get to the design capacity of the pipeline. But again, typically that is for brief periods, where you may be able to exceed, your annual capacity.
Okay, and that design capacity is how much?
It would be, well, I believe the number is 657.
657. So there are days in the summertime when you'd be running?
Well, not an entire day. Okay. It'd be certain hours of a given day that you could.
You would be running as many as approximately 650,000 barrels at that rate.
At that rate for a short period of time.
Okay, great. That's all I needed then. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Any other interveners have a question? Staff, do you have any questions of?
I do, but I just need a moment to ask a question of Mr. Kennecke before I proceed, if that's acceptable.
Okay, should we just... I think we're going to take a 5-minute break, everybody. Give Sherry a little break and let's go back on the record, Sherry. Mr. Thomas, you're still on the stand and under oath, and staff, following your conference with Mr. Kennecke, do you intend to proceed with questions?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Let's go to commissioner questions. Mr. Kolbeck?
Yes, Mr. Thomas. Just so I'm clear, your SCADA system does not use any, excuse me, any internet, any IP protocol. They don't meet at any point. Is that correct?
The SCADA system itself is isolated from all of the other business-related systems.
Okay. Is it anywhere close to the public domain?
No.
Okay. Is it realistic to believe that a 2% or a 1.5% leak can go undetected? Is that a realistic assumption?
Well, not for the 90-day period that's been indicated. That really was intended to sort of bookend things. A 1.5% leak, based upon my experience, would never go for a period of 90 days. What was intended in the report was to really describe a leak that would be, you know, far less than the 1.5 that could go for something like 90 days. But leaks of that size would more typically be something that would be measured in drips per hour or something along that line, something very small. A leak of 1.5% to go on for 90 days is well, again, I can't say the probability is zero, but it is just extremely, extremely unlikely. Like it's, in my opinion, it could not happen.
Okay. We talked about your pump stations, and it takes two pump stations out of power to actually shut down the line. How many layers of power protection are there at the control center, actually, where your technicians will be stationed? I should say your SCADA technicians will be stationed.
Okay. Within the control center in Calgary, we actually have a main and a standby or backup control center. The main control center is backed up with an emergency generator, and then we have as well the option to go to the backup site, and it as well has a backup generator. The pump stations themselves are fed by the utilities, and because they're large 4,000 and 5,000 horsepower motors, there is no backup power for those pumping units.
Okay, if there was at the where your technicians were stationed in Calgary, if there was say some sort of natural disaster or something, is there a default where the pipeline just automatically shuts down?
It's an operator-driven command, though, okay, that would be necessary to drive to those sorts of limits. But again, in the event of an entire loss of communication, as I described with the one station that would drive to these safe limits, all of the stations, you know, if it was a total communication failure, all of the pump stations drive to those safe limits as well.
Okay.
I might just add to that if that were to occur, you know, we'll have this redundant form of communications that hopefully we would be able to resume communications. In the event we weren't, though, we would actually shut the pipeline down. If it were necessary, we would call out our people that are on call and basically shut the pipeline down in a case like that.
Okay. Now, I know in some industries they're still dealing with 30-year-old technology. They don't upgrade. Is a SCADA system a 30-year-old technology, or is that upgraded just like Windows 98 NT? Does that follow the same pattern?
Yes, it very much does.
Okay. It's not a stagnant sort of a technology. It's actually an ever-evolving technology.
Yes. One of the companies that we're dealing with now is their name is Telvent. They've built control systems for mini pipelines in North America and worldwide. And they would typically have a new release about every 2 years.
Okay. After an abnormal operation, what records are formed and who receives them?
In the case of an abnormal operation?
Any abnormal operation, a high pressure, low pressure, whatever. Correct. Is there a form that's, or a procedure, is that outlined in federal law then? Or is that a TransCanada procedure?
Yes. Other than reporting overpressure issues when you exceed MAOP or MOP, excuse me, reports to PHMSA are necessary in that case. Within the SCADA system, every event is logged so that basically every signal received from a field device, every command sent by an operator, everything is logged. We will also have local at each pump station pressure recording equipment, so that we'll be continuously recording suction case and discharge pressures, and that is maintained permanently as well.
Okay, and that's kept on site at your TransCanada headquarters?
That's correct, yes. Okay.
I think you've answered that. I was just wondering about the satellite communications. I was wondering if it ran on fiber, frame relay, or IP technology, but you're telling me that it's probably going to run on satellite.
That's currently our expectation. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is your forte, but maybe Mr. Kennecke can get me. I was wondering if I could get a job requirement or a qualification for the regional, the emergency site manager and the first responders. Is there, like, if you were to post a job application somewhere, could I see one of those sometime? As to the requirements, yes, of what it takes to get a job like that?
Well, and yeah,
we can make that possible.
Is that possible?
Okay. Sure.
And also for your, if you were to hire someone in your SCADA center, could I see one of those too?
An operator?
Yeah. What a job requirements are.
Yeah. Sure.
I'm sure it's not an eighth grader, but I'd just like to know what the qualifications of them are.
Yes. Yeah.
So, okay. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Commissioner Hansen, any questions? Commissioner Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Smith. Mr. Thomas, let's talk a little bit about the local responders. On page 6 of your direct, you note that, and I'm looking at sub-item 12 here, establishing and maintaining liaison with fire, police, and other appropriate public officials. And I won't read that whole section, but can you give us a little better idea of what information you'll be providing to locals and what information you'll need to get from them?
Yes, I can. That is done as part of TransCanada's public awareness program, where we conduct sessions with all of those groups to, I guess, make them aware of what our emergency response processes and procedures are, and then they likewise make us aware of what theirs are, such that we can work together in the event there's a need to involve one another, so to speak.
And will every single fire department and police department along the route be met with and given the appropriate information?
Yes, they certainly will, as well as, the landowners are normally provided with information that relates to the pipeline and the product shipped and so on. That is included as part of the public awareness program, in addition to these endeavors that work with the local emergency response folks as well.
And is this an ongoing process?
It's an ongoing process. Yes, it is.
And I didn't establish your expertise in this area, but do you happen to know how often contact would be made?
I know that contact with local emergency responders is offered annually. So it's basically at their discretion. It's offered annually.
You note in your direct that local responders, although not expected to respond to an oil incident, might be required to help battle secondary fires. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Is any additional, in your experience, having worked on other pipelines, is any additional equipment ever required for those local responders that they wouldn't normally have?
No, I haven't, in my experience, came across a condition where that was necessary. Not to my knowledge.
The operations control center, is there redundancy there as well as an alternate site?
Yes, there is. We have a site that is located, I'll say, in reasonably close proximity to Calgary, that is a fully redundant backup control center.
Some interveners have noted, and I can probably find a specific example if you want one, but some interveners have noted that they believe it's impossible to fully remediate an area that has been touched by an oil by a failure or an incident or a spill. Has that been your experience in the industry?
Well, again, I'm not an expert in that area, but you know, I think Mr. Gray's kind of used the analogy that you know, after the pipeline goes through, you know, you attempt to restore the land to basically as good a condition as you can. You know, you can't make it 100% back to normal, and I guess that the same to some degree would be true in a leak situation. There would certainly, though, if you know, I guess if there was crop loss, etc., you know, certainly those issues would be worked out financially with the landowner.
And do you have a familiarity with generally how that process works?
The
assessment, the assessment of crop damage if the land isn't 100% back to normal?
That, like, I haven't been involved in those activities directly.
You described the process by which information comes into the operations center. The operator analyzes the alarm and then evaluates other information to try to determine whether or not that's a false positive. You mentioned some mandatory timeline. What would that time frame be typically?
That would be in the range of like 10 to 15 minutes. So that at the expiry of those 10 to 15 minutes, a line shutdown would be mandatory.
Are there any federal regulations or rules regarding that mandatory time frame?
No, there are not.
Okay. Have you had an opportunity to review Mr. Miller's direct testimony? Ed Miller's.
Yeah, I believe I have.
Okay, and I can... rather than make you dig for it, I'll just mention in general terms, Mr. Miller indicates that there have been some reports that have indicated in the past GATA systems have actually made accidents worse, or they've contributed to the severity of an accident. Do you have a response to that?
Well, I guess I can't speak specifically to that. There are such a variety of SCADA systems, you know, utilized by pipeline operators that it, in some respects, is difficult to address that.
Have you had an opportunity to review the 2005 National Transportation Safety Board report on this topic?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Mr. Smith, that's all I've got right now. Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to bring up again before we go to redirect. Pardon me, Commissioner Hansen, I'm sorry.
I had just, thank you, Mr. Smith. I had just deferred to Chairman Johnson. Appreciate that. Good morning, Ms. Thompson.
Good morning.
Fortunately, a lot of the questions I had have already been asked and answered, and I also appreciate your anticipation of some of those questions that were asked and discussed yesterday, especially regarding the check valves and your explanation of that in your opening remarks. I do have a few questions, though, and the first one pertains to your direct testimony. I don't know that you have to turn to it. It's on page 8 in paragraph 11. I get a little concerned with semantics on occasion. Perhaps I get too concerned with it, but in your on the top of the page, on page 8, you talk about the first leak detection method, and in the second paragraph refer to remote monitoring is typically able to detect leaks down to approximately 25. I get a little concerned there when you say it typically is able to detect leaks. Is it not always able to detect? Down to sounds like... perhaps you're minimizing 25% or 30%. Maybe it's just the semantics that I'm overly concerned with. But that's a rupture, isn't it? That's a huge.
It is. And that is probably, I guess the intent there wasn't to say typically. Certainly, you know, it's been my experience and, having worked in and with control center operators for a considerable period of time, that leaks of that size are detected virtually immediately by the operator. There is a, you know, a large drop in pressure, a large change in flow rate that is basically noticed immediately.
So all the bells and the whistles are going off at that juncture. It's not something that you occasionally discover when it goes off. It's
absolutely. Like, there's no missing something like
all right.
that.
At the bottom of that, of those four items, you talk about four different areas in which redundancy to back up to find leaks. And one of them, you use the word finally and refer to aerial patrols, et cetera, public awareness. But in your rebuttal on number four, I believe it's paragraph number four, you state that you elaborate quite a bit about Keystone will also incorporate computer-based, non-real-time, accumulated gain loss, et cetera. Is this something that is typical, the item number four? The reason I ask is because I reviewed my notes from the four meetings that we had as we went from town to town, and you spoke of the SCADA system, of course, and you spoke of the other, well, the system of which you could ascertain within 8 seconds. There were a variety of different techniques, but you never addressed this particular one, at least in my notes, and I'm not the best note taker, so I may have missed it, but out of four times, I would hope that I'd have caught it. Is that a typical exercise?
A system such as this, I'll say, from my understanding, it isn't typical. I would also add to that I tried to do my best to describe this this system at our public sessions. But I was trying to describe it kind of under bullet two, again, of my direct, you know, being part of the volume balance system, so that to try to maybe explain in a little bit more detail, what I've described in my direct testimony and those four bullets are systems that would be used to the extent you can instantaneously detect leaks, whereas this accumulated loss gain system is one that isn't really working at real time. So it's accumulating losses and gains within pipeline segments and then taking and summing those, you know, over the course of hours, days, months, and so on, and it's that system that would allow you to detect leaks, again, under this 1.5 to 2% threshold.
So this is a system that you use elsewhere. This is not a new system.
It's not a new system. It's really utilizing the same system as described in the volume balance area of my testimony.
On page 10, paragraph 15 at the top, you speak of there are other systems and methods in place that will serve to identify leaks of this side, and you gave one example. Perhaps that relates somewhat to what we were just discussing. However, when you use the word other systems, plural, are there other methods that will be in place that have not yet been explained in any of your testimony?
The other was intended to mean the system that we just spoke of, along with the external or direct observation methodologies.
So there aren't any additional ones besides what have been presented either here or in your direct testimony?
That's correct.
Okay. Are you aware of any problems with, I'll skip that. I think it's been covered enough on the SCADA systems. I was concerned a little bit with false positives and challenges in other systems, but I think that's been directed enough. I'm familiar with having practiced drills and what we call tabletops in emergency operations centers. Will you be conducting, or will those type of operations be conducted?
Yes, they certainly will. We have actually a schedule well, again, it is a code requirement to have a certain frequency in terms of drills. Tabletops are conducted, field deployment exercises are conducted, and major deployment exercises with others are also conducted.
Excellent, thank you. In your direct testimony on page 23, paragraph 29, you speak of an oil spill response plan. Will that be, is there a requirement that that be approved prior to operation?
Yes, Keystone will submit that plan first quarter of 2009 for PHMSA's review and approval.
Did you say, or is there in any of your testimony, did you say, it seemed like you did, that there would be Keystone emergency personnel in North Dakota? Will there be?
Excuse me.
Will there be Keystone, TransCanada, Keystone personnel in North Dakota who could respond to an emergency situation?
Yes.
And because we seem to be confining ourselves in some of the previous discussion to Yankton, as if you've got folks in Yankton and perhaps up in Canada. I assume that you have folks in North Dakota as well, and that there's not an imaginary line that they're prohibited from crossing on the border. How close are they to South Dakota?
Well, no, that's absolutely true. We will have people positioned, again, so that we can respond to any location along the pipeline within that four-hour time period. So we will have, you know, people positioned at various points along the pipeline right away to be able to accomplish that.
Do you have a location specific at this time for North Dakota?
No, that I don't have.
In response to a question regarding remediation, this is just for, I assume you misspoke, but I was just interested in the mechanics of the skimming process. You had said that the skimmer would skim oil from on top of the oil. Did you mean on top of the water?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Because we recognize it flows, but we also recognize there's degradation and it filters through into the water. I didn't know whether it was just a system that confined itself to a portion of that oil or how it was. But thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Other commissioner questions? I maybe have just maybe a couple questions. Would your characterization of the SCADA and other monitoring and response systems that you're intending to implement here, would you characterize those as state-of-the-art systems?
Yes, I would. I guess in my experience, I've had the opportunity to visit a number of control centers and some of the very large control centers here in the United States that control significant pipelines, certainly what we are planning with Keystone will be consistent with those facilities,
and consistent with the best there are.
Absolutely, yes.
And so basically, if you know, from at least your point of view, if the commission were to deny the pipeline permit on the basis of inadequate monitoring and safety systems, would it be your opinion that no pipeline could be permitted in the state, period? Crude oil pipeline
that,
or other petroleum product pipeline?
That would be my opinion, yes.
Thank you. Right now I'm going to ask again of interveners that have been scheduled time and apologize. If there's anyone that needs to get out of here that doesn't plan to stay for a while, if you want to go now so you can get going, we can try to do that and accommodate before redirect and an additional examination by parties of Mr. Thomas. Is there anybody that either wants to or feels an urgency to get it over with and go?
From a practical standpoint, if you don't do it now, you're going to get bumped after lunch.
That's probably the case, because the commissioners have a commitment at over the noon hour, so we're going to have to take a break at noon. And that's why I'm asking. I just don't know. I don't know if there's people have to get to another meeting or home to feed cattle or what your needs might be. So let me know if you want to get going and leave. I'm not hearing anybody. I haven't seen any hands raised. So let's move along and see if we can't conclude, Mr. Thomas, before noon. Oh,
Ms. Anderson.
Do you want to be able to get going, Lillian? Okay.
When you said get bumped, does that mean just an hour? Or?
Yeah, we're going to hear everybody.
This afternoon?
Yeah, right away. Yep. Right away, yeah, right after lunch. I just didn't know, John, there's some people that have cattle and they need to get back, and I don't know what people need. And we'll accommodate you if you have the need to get going. Okay.
We're not trying to force you to spend money in Pier for lunch or anything like that. That's what we're trying to say. Oh.
With that, I think we'll move along and see if we can conclude Mr. Thomas before lunch.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas, do you recall whether there are conditions contained within the special permit relative to the SCADA system?
Yes, there are.
Can you generally describe them? Or?
Yes, I can. In discussing the SCADA system with PHMSA personnel, one of their concerns was in relation to the scan cycle. And by that, what I mean is the scan cycle is typically referred to the amount of time it takes you to scan your complete network of pump stations. So you start at station A, so to speak. It talks to the host. You go to B all the way through, so to speak. And Keystone's scan cycle, we expect to be able to meet a 3 to 5 second cycle so that we will have scanned and brought back information from each of the Keystone stations every 3 to 5 seconds.
Mr. Thomas, that's not the only SCADA requirement within the special permit, is it?
No, there are a number of other SCADA-related conditions with respect to operator training, alarm-related issues. There have recently been situations that I would describe as like alarm overload, and there are certain recommendations that are on the record with respect to how one manages those alarms such that an operator is not in a position of alarm overload and can deal with the alarms received and such. So there are a number of other SCADA operator-related conditions that are part of the PHMSA waiver. Another that comes to mind is the a fatigue-related issue. There are concerns with operator fatigue as well.
And if is one of those requirements that you meet any regulations developed as a result of the 2005 NTSB SCADA study?
Yes, it is.
Can you explain briefly what that means?
The NTSB study put forward a number of recommendations, again, related to SCADA and operator things such as fatigue and so on. And basically, we will be required to implement those associated recommendations.
Do you have your direct testimony in front of you, Mr. Thomas?
Yes, I do.
I'd like to direct you to questions 17, 18, and 19, just briefly. I'm not asking to read them. Given that context, can you explain the process for finalization of the emergency response plan from this point where you're at right now? Can you just briefly explain the process going forward to finalize?
Yes, I can. We have provided, and again, it was part of the application, this preliminary oil spill response plan. Once the designs have been completed and the route finalized, we will finalize the oil spill response plan. This is something that is a large undertaking. It will take thousands of man hours because of the very specific details you have to get into in preparing these plans. So that work will be undertaken. We're going to begin in January of next year, and as I mentioned, we'll have it complete in the first quarter of 2009. It will be submitted to PHMSA at that point for their review and approval, and the actual line fill of Keystone is scheduled to commence about November of 2009. So we'll have approximately 9 months there to train employees, familiarize employees with the plan prior to the actual pipeline line fill commencing.
Mr. Thomas, can you open, please, Exhibit C, July 1, 2006? Have you got that handy? It's the DNV report, the first one.
Yes, I have.
If you'd flip, please, to page 1. And go down to the fifth paragraph. Do you see the discussion of 657,000 barrels per day?
Yes, I do.
Are you familiar with that paragraph, and can you tell me what that means?
I can. The 657,000 barrel a day is, again, the pipeline design rate. That, as I explained earlier, is the rate that we might expect to exceed, or pardon me, achieve for a couple of hour period, sometime during a 24-hour period. The annual rate is 591,000. That is the rate that we would expect to be able to achieve 365 days of the year.
Thank you. I have nothing further.
Is there any follow-up cross-examination, Mr. Rasmussen?
I have nothing further.
Any follow-on cross, recross? Mr. Hone, do you have any?
Mr. Thomas, there was testimony presented by a state expert, Mr. Walsh, that you questioned. I believe he listed 25,000 barrels in one of his equations, and you, on page 6 of your rebuttal.
I'll object. This is new cross and didn't come up on either redirect or direct testimony.
I'm going to let it go. We'd just soon know the answer if there's an issue.
It's a clarification. On page 6, you disputed his number, and I want to make sure I understand what the difference was. I believe on page 6 you're listing 21,384 barrels. Is that correct? At the top of page 6, there's a reference on the right to 21,384 barrels.
Yes, I see that.
And how does that relate to Mr. Walsh's 25,000 barrels? I believe it's on the previous page.
I'm not sure how to relate that to Mr. Walsh. I can certainly explain in detail how
please do.
We've calculated these numbers, but
it seemed, and I guess my question is, were you disputing his 25,000 barrel estimate? It appeared that you were disputing his 25,000 barrel and were listing 21,000 on page 6.
I guess we weren't disputing the volumes. What we were doing is explaining the basis and of how our spill volume calculations are done. So to do that, and I might mention to begin with that these calculations that we've provided here in my rebuttal testimony are the manner in which pipeline companies calculate worst-case spill volumes that are used in development of the emergency response plans. So what we've done here is basically calculated, again, along each point milepost, I'll say, of the pipeline, what the worst-case spill volume would be. And we've provided it for the two cases, the 435 and the 591,000 barrel per day case. What is done in these calculations is you basically look at two parts in terms of calculating volumes. When you're calculating a worst-case discharge. The first part, as I've referred to here, is called the dynamic phase, or that is the amount of oil that might leak while the pipeline is still operating. Then once the appropriate amount of time, you know, based upon the very procedures we were talking about in the control center and so on, have elapsed and the valves are closed, then you go about calculating how much oil will actually leak out at a given leak site, assuming no repair containment activities are done whatsoever. So you assume the entire volume between those two valves that are used to isolate the segment actually spills.
And on page 6, then, at the top, would your sort of worst-case estimate at that location be 21,384 barrels?
At that example point, that's correct.
Okay. Could you go back to page 3, then, of your rebuttal, a couple pages back? That's question 6.
Yes.
And question 6 is referring to Mr. Walsh indicating that the emergency response team would have to evacuate and clamp a large leak within 45 minutes to limit the large leak to 25,000 barrels, correct? That's what it's the question.
That's what it's stated.
And you were responding to that, right, in the following page 6? That was part of your response to that question? Was page 6 responding to question 6?
Was page 6 responding?
Was your response on the top of page 6 responding to question 6?
I guess what the response described was the again the worst case spill analysis for the two rate cases of 435 and 591,000 barrels a day.
So the difference is approximately 3,000 barrel difference between what he estimated and what you estimate?
I believe Mr. Walsh's comments were more directed to a smaller, medium-sized leak as opposed to a large leak. I think it's important to note that in the event of a large leak, which again is a worst case discharge analysis, there is part like the calculation does not include a time to actually repair the leak because you're assuming the full contents of the pipeline between isolated valves are lost.
Okay, thank you. One other question regarding the operator stationed at the control center monitoring the SCADA system for this pipeline. Would that operator also have monitoring responsibilities for other pipelines that TransCanada owns?
He may in the future to some extent, although I wouldn't expect that to be the case. This operator will be located in Calgary initially with the other operators that operate various TransCanada pipelines. It would be my view that the Keystone system would occupy an operator, and that there, from a facility perspective and a batching perspective, that a full-time operator would need to be dedicated to Keystone on a full-time basis.
And would the control center that person or persons is working in, would that be dedicated as well to this pipeline?
Sorry,
the computer monitoring equipment and the control center, would that particular center be dedicated to the pipeline?
The center would not, but the computer system, the SCADA system, all would be dedicated to Keystone.
Thank you.
Any follow-up staff questions?
No.
Commissioners, any last questions? Any redirect, re-redirect?
I'd like to ask just two questions, if I might, Mr. Smith. Mr. Thomas, are the calculated worst case and other case spill volumes that we've discussed here today, are they done for planning purposes?
Yes, these calculations that we've presented within the DNV report and the later exhibits are not the complete and final calculations that will be done. As I mentioned, as part of our transport and fade analysis, we will basically recalculate these worst-case discharge, include a transport and fade analysis, and that is the information that our ERP will be based upon.
So if I'm understanding correctly, the numbers and spill volumes you've discussed, calculated worst-case and other-case spill volumes, they're not predictions of what will happen along the pipeline.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, I think you're excused.
Thank you.
We're now at 10 to 12. We, the commissioners, have a commitment over lunch on another matter. So I think we're going to be in recess until 1 o'clock. Is that sufficient? How about 1:05 after 1? That gives everybody an hour and 15 minutes. Thanks.